I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Amelia Turk. Welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, you've been a very busy person in recent times, Amelia. You've been completing your secondary studies at John Curtin College in Frio. You've been off at COP28 in Dubai, and you're now just seeing what's happening to the climate, I gather, in Denmark, Copenhagen, of all places. But we're here particularly to talk about COP28. How did you get into COP28?
I'm quite involved in the international youth space. As you said, I've just completed high school at John Curtin, but I've been very involved with the international youth constituency and kind of looking more at how Australian youth are able to be engaged in the international space. And so through this, constant all year round work, I was lucky enough to secure a badge through Macquarie University. So I sent an email out to some organisations and some universities seeing if they had a spare badge, which is like an entry pass to COP28 pretty much. And so, through this, all of this work throughout the year, I was able to meet everyone at COP28 and to be there to see, I guess, how much more of an impact you can have on ground as opposed to being on Zoom calls the whole time.
Well, it's fascinating. I came across a lovely speech that the Fremantle MP, Josh Wilson, read out in the Commonwealth Parliament just a couple of years ago. Amelia, he chose a speech that you'd written when you were still in year 11, and I love the concept. I'll just read from it briefly. It's 2072, and COP77 is being held in Australia. The world is in awe trying to comprehend the feat that Australia has achieved. In short, we become the good guys in Australia when it comes to climate change and responding. Now, how did you first become involved, if you like, intellectually or emotionally in this important topic?
Yes, I actually started my advocacy journey back when I was in year four, so around 2015, 2016. I became involved a lot with like some local organisations. So one of them is called Millennium Kids, and I've been a part of that ever since. And also in school, I was always really interested to be in all the sustainability groups. So I started off really grassroots, and then it was only, last year in 2022, when I was able to go on exchange to Europe, and I thought it was a really good opportunity to see, what else was going on around the world. And so that's when I really became involved in the international stuff. But yeah, most of my work has been looking at climate education and also sustainability within schools within Perth.
The whole business of international cooperation, of course, is not only crucial to achieving climate control around the planet, but those personal relationships, I suppose, that come out of it might be considered critical as well. Let's just talk a little bit about COP28. Fremantle Shipping News has covered earlier COPs with Bill Hare from Climate Analytics and Peter Newman from Curtin University reporting back to us here in Frio about what happened. One of the things that always astonishes me is just the size of the whole thing and how many people are there and where they come from and how they're all housed and fed and looked after. Can we talk about the size and enormity of the conference?
You make a really valid point that these sort of conferences, they obviously also take up a lot of energy and a lot of space within the city. This year it was obviously held in Dubai in the UAE, and it was the largest climate conference that's ever taken place. I think overall there were over 115,000 delegates there throughout the 2 weeks.
Whoa.
I think at max there were about 75,000 on one day. And you could really feel it the whole time. There were the lines into registration, if you were there after, let's say, 7:30 a.m. or maybe even 7, it would take you an hour and a half, 2 hours to get into the venue. I think what the problem with having so many people there, right, is that there are so many people who want an opportunity to speak. And normally climate conferences of maximum of about, 20,000, that would even have been considered large, and probably for COP29 we're looking at a significantly smaller conference than we've just had in Dubai. But yeah, I lived an hour and a half away from the conference venue, and I had to be at the conference venue at 7:50 or 6:50, 7 o'clock each morning. So I was, leaving really early, and I think that, also impacted the amount of energy that everyone had while they were at the COP as well. So that's a really big part of it, is how does the logistical side of it really impact the negotiations? I mean, it was funny because I was did have the opportunity to, randomly meet some of the other Australian delegates or the Australian delegation just on the metro, because I was on the metro for 1 hour and 20 minutes each day. So it did enable some new conversations, but it was a very, very big venue. It took me 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes to walk from the youth constituency office over to the Australian Pavilion. So, it was certainly a very, very large venue in comparison to previous years.
Now, you were there as one of the Australian youth representatives. How many of you were there?
Yeah, so there were about 120 Australian youth who were on ground, through all different sorts of organisations. Some were able to be funded by the Australian government, through a grant process. Others received overflow badges, but the large majority of us, or maybe about half of us, were there through observer badges. So through organisations, through universities, things like that. It was a significant increasement to how it was a few years ago, or even last year in Sharm el-Sheikh, or the year before now. I think it was a really good opportunity, because we were able to meet, when you're in Australia, though it's such a large country, and so for us to ever meet in person in Australia is actually, the chance is slimmer there than for us to meet at an international climate conference 5,000 kilometres away from Australia. So it really did allow for a really good opportunity, not only for Australian voices to be seen and to be heard, but also for us to meet internally and to decide, I guess, what the next steps are in the future.
Now, there was an Australian youth statement, was there not? Tell us a little bit about what was in it, where did it get presented, and was it consistent with what the Australian government representations to COP28 were?
That's a really interesting question. So we created an Australian Youth Statement on the basis of what are called local conferences of youth, which is kind of an umbrella term for conferences that are organised by the youth constituency to the UNFCCC in collaboration with local organisations in each of the countries. And we had over 100 LCOYs, or local conferences of youth, throughout the world. And so this year in Australia, we had a really successful set of LCOYs, and as a result of that, we did create, as you correctly said, we created a statement encompassing some or most of the views of Australian youth in relation to climate change. A lot of it was on climate education, making sure that there are First Nations voices and First Nations knowledge included and respected when we're looking at the climate, climate decisions that are going on. We also had parts on adaptation and mitigation. And also in general, just Asia Pacific relations. We know that that's a really important part of it, and it's something that the Australian government has been, looking at. We obviously had the recent deal where climate migrants were able to enter Australia. But in general, what we as Australian youth found is that we're always going to have a bit more ambitious targets than the Australian government will have, and that was quite obvious that, we as Australian youth tend to have a slightly different terms of reference as to, what we want to see changed. What I will say, though, is we were able to present this statement not only in Canberra, so we had some of the LCOY team in Canberra present it to the minister and to other ministers and members of parliament, but we also presented it at COP28 to Minister Bowen and Assistant Minister McAllister. So it was a really good opportunity for us to, showcase the cohesion within the Australian youth, and looking at how a youth statement can be so beneficial. We also were able to use it in combination with the Global Youth Statement, which is like the Australian Youth Statement, but for obviously the whole globe, which had about 775,000 inputs. So that, is a much, much, much larger scale process. Which was really good to be able to use the Australian statement to showcase how we have the same views as other youth around the world, which I think, just makes government feel a bit more inclined to have to act on it, because they see that it's not just 200 Australian youth, but it's, hundreds of thousands of youth around the world.
At the beginning of COP28, there were high hopes for what the final communique might say, and like any process whereby the nations on this planet all have to come together and work out something they can say in common, there are enormous challenges. And I imagine even amongst the different youth groups from different countries, there might have been as well. But what from a broad point of view, was your hope for what COP28 might say at the end, and what did the final statement actually say?
Yeah, so you make a really good point about the fact that it is a party-driven process, which acts on consensus. So there's always going to be differences to what certain parties would like to see and then what's in the end text. My hope, and the hope of quite a number of youth, I think I can say, was that there would be mention of a full fossil fuel phase out, that there would also be strong language on human rights, youth rights, Indigenous rights, also making sure that the Loss and Damage Fund was being institutionalized and also had very adequate funds in it. So I guess, there were lots and lots of hopes of just making some general progress and really proving that even in a COP which is held in a country with lots of oil and gas, that even then it would have been possible to have some, strong outcomes for the future. And unfortunately, or you could, some will say that there were some small developments, but generally, the outcomes were quite a lot lower than what a number of parties had wanted and what civil society organisations had wanted. So instead of being a full fossil fuel phase out, it was a transition away from fossil fuels and energy systems. And so there was mention of fossil fuels, which, yes, that is a really good thing, but it was quite a lot watered down to what was expected, and that's just a result of the consensus-based process. But there were a few good things, including the institutionalization of the loss and damage opera sorry yeah institutionalization of the Loss and Damage Fund, and also the institutionalization of the Youth Climate Champion Voice. So there were a few good things, but overall a number of people were quite disappointed as to what the outcomes were. Hopefully, that can change for COP29 or even other SBs in Bonn.
I imagine, like at all these big international conferences where it is important to have a communique at the end of it, and everyone knows there's going to be something, that somebody's in charge of drafting the latest text and circulating it and seeing who's going to agree with it and who wants to add a comma or a dash or change a word or 10. How did you get to see all of these proposed texts as they went flying around, and where did they come from? Who was preparing them?
Yeah, whether we saw all of the texts is quite that's probably quite unlikely. They do release generally the draft texts for all of, well, for the first global stocktake, but also just in general for all of the different negotiation tracks and the different agenda items. You're right to say that it is a few people who are making, the big changes, and even the little things like where does the comma go? It's all happening within the negotiation rooms, which to civil society are mostly closed off. A lot of them are closed meetings. And so as civil society or as youth, we have to, make a stance outside of the negotiation rooms. The global stocktake text was, it was quite a strategic move in the sense that there was a really, really bad text released on the first day. No mention of fossil fuels, really bad language on human rights. It was very concerning, and all the parties were very concerned with it. What happened all of a sudden, though, is the next morning, a new draft was released, which was slightly better, had the words transitioning away from fossil fuels. And all of a sudden, the text was adopted. So the speed and the ability for countries to agree to something without there being enough or adequate time for other organizations and even other parties to look through it, is, I found it to be quite remarkable. I don't, none of us were really expecting it, a text to be released and an hour and a half later, it to be adopted. So that was a really surprising thing for all of us.
I suppose at any such conference, you can find yourself almost celebrity gazing. Do you see the Secretary General of the United Nations wandering past? Do you see presidents or prime ministers, if not other
Yeah.
people? Do you get to rub shoulders with them? Do you get introduced to people?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great opportunity to network with people and also just to, see people. We had an Australian, I guess, like a liaison, or I think they were called a focal point, which is just about transmitting information to youth. And we often got messages being like, there's a former prime minister at the Australian Pavilion, come by and, see them. So we would all waddle over to see Julia Gillard or Malcolm Turnbull and things like that. So there were definitely a few opportunities. A few opportunities to be able to meet with some people who, I guess for some are celebrities in a way, and people who are able to make big decisions. We, as younger at the youth constituency, we're often able to have bilateral, so like meetings one on one or 40 youth with one high level person sort of thing. And so that was, opportunities to just hear from those people and to hear their perspectives are so important. But what I will say is that also just the connections that you can have with other activists on ground, and also just government officials who are there, not necessarily as ministers or prime ministers, but also who are there just as part of the delegation. It's a really rare chance to be able to, just see somebody on the metro or see somebody near a negotiation room and just sit down with them for 40 minutes to hear their views. That's a really, really important part of a COP, in my opinion. Even if we can't be involved in the negotiations as much, we do have that ability to, try and influence things outside of negotiation rooms.
Are they formal presentations that you're describing where you might hear someone talking for 40 minutes?
So if we do have when they are bilaterals, they're often in a, specific room, and they're with high-level UNFCCC officials or COP presidency or anything like that. But a lot of them are also informal. A lot of them were me happening to see two people from the Australian delegation while we were eating lunch, and then sitting down and having discussions. So not all of them have to be formal. And I think what you often find is that the informal discussions are where people are actually listening more because they're not stressed about other things. So then because of that, you're able to actually have a more constructive discussion. And then I mean, we were able to see how our informal discussions were able to influence some of the Australia's positions on other topics as well. So I think that was really important as well to be able to see how change does happen just through conversations.
I'm wondering what your general impressions are of the groups or the categories or individuals who were there. Is everyone sort of committed to net zero, or do you fear there might be a few foxes amongst the hens in the hen house?
Yeah, I feel like that. I mean, there are almost certainly a few foxes amongst around the hen house. I think you're always going to have people of varying opinions. And I mean, having 100,000 people at a conference, of course, not everyone is going to agree on anything. What we have got, though, was the Paris Agreement, right? Which is really trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that was kind of the overall stance that everyone had. We all had like little pins saying 1.5 degrees, just reminding everyone of that common goal that we do all have. But yes, there are 100% some conflicting ideologies about, the importance of fossil fuels or the importance of a loss and damage fund. Not only with like the private sector, but even within different governments, you really saw how different parties from around the world had different agendas.
Well, tell me this, just from an Australian perspective, were there lots of us there in the various categories?
Yes, we did have quite a large representation in general. I don't have the exact figures, but we had a significant amount of Australians on overflow badges for the first time. So we had 60 Australian youth on overflow badges, and that was 20% of all of the youth. So we did actually have, a few hundred Australians who were there or able to attend through government or through overflow badges, which is like you're not a government official, but you're just receiving like an entry pass, a badge into COP through the government. But yeah, overall, there was quite a big presence. I was, especially with the youth, I was always told, oh, wow, you've actually been able to mobilise 100 Australian youth. We held a social event, and I'm pretty sure the youth constituency held a social event, and I'm pretty sure Australia was had the largest representation of people. So I think I think it was a huge development, and what I found is, even just walking around, you could hear an Australian accent from anywhere. And I think, when you hear that Australian accent, you go, okay, I'm not alone in this. And that was, quite a universal feeling to be able to see other Australians there fighting together, having networking events and talking to them, people who are working in the oil and gas sector, but working in the sustainability section of that, to youth who, are working on climate education, to government officials working on making sure that we have money set aside to help developing countries. There's so many different points of it, and so many Australians working in different parts of the COP.
It sounds like a most wonderful event, and certainly for youth, including yourself, to be there, to experiencing it, and to be able to learn and advance from those positions. Inevitably, there are disappointments with COPs. Everyone comes away, not so much gnashing their teeth, but reflecting on what could have been done better or whatever. What about this time from your point of view? What were the disappointments?
Yeah, so as I already said before, there were definitely some disappointments in the text, in the final text. There were a few compromises that had to be made just to get fossil fuels in the text. So, yeah, one of the disappointments from my side was, I think, just realizing how little influence civil society organizations and youth can actually have when everything is happening behind closed doors. As I said before, the sudden adoption of the first global stocktake was something which we had no influence over. And I think a real learning opportunity for me was, yes, we spent many, many hours creating position papers as a youth constituency, but really they have very, very little influence because the parties have already decided on their own, major drawbacks or their own major sticking points way before the COP. So I think, yeah, it's a really important thing to understand that a COP is only 2 weeks and decisions are made in, a time frame spanning way longer than 2 weeks. And so I think it's something, yeah, to consider whether it's worth investing as much energy into something knowing that it isn't going to happen. And I think what we find is that even, I mean, especially being in a country like the UAE, where there are a number of restrictions as to what can be done from an outsider's perspective. I mean, obviously, you often will see large climate marches by youth at these events, and things like that, for example, weren't possible this year at all due to UAE regulation. We had to apply for every single action or every single protest that we had, and they were significantly smaller than normal. So I think, a disappointment from that is really just observing, how little influence there actually can be from any civil society, regardless of whether it's, or maybe not business, but, regardless of whether it's youth or whether it's Indigenous people, there's very little that we can do.
The really interesting point you make, the importance of civil society in our own country is acknowledged, and it's enormous. Governments couldn't operate properly without it. Did you get a sense that there was a strong civil society movement in, if not all, many other countries represented at COP28?
I think in terms of presence on ground from civil society organizations, obviously, as I said before, it was a very large COP with a lot of registration. So that really did allow for a lot of people on the yellow observer badges and a lot of people working for different civil society organizations. And there were a few instances where we really did band together, all of the constituencies, all of the organizations. There were a few times where it was like, okay, we can fight for this collectively and have 40,000, in theory, 40,000 people pushing all governments for that. I think we were very lucky in the Australian sense that they generally are very happy to have stakeholder meetings with us and to brief us on things. Prior to COP, we had a few sessions with the head of delegation and just with Australia's delegation in general to understand, what they were going to aim for COP. And I think that was something which not all other countries do. But that being said, it is really just about information sharing and the transfer of knowledge between the different countries and between the different civil society branches within Australia. So I think, yeah, it's really important to see that everybody is able to work together to, really advocate for stronger action rather than it being all the different governments, all of the different businesses, all of the different researchers, all working separately.
Now, where will the next COP be?
Yeah, so the next COP will be in Azerbaijan in Baku. It will be start of November or yeah, mid-November, so it'll be about a month earlier than COP28 in the year. So it's actually not very far away now. It's about, 10 months, 10, 11 months.
Now, from a youth perspective, or just thinking in broader policy terms from an Australian point of view, what would you suggest that everybody do differently if that's the case, or do to prepare fully for Azerbaijan?
Yeah, I think Azerbaijan, we know that there will be a lot of focus on the new collective quantified goal, the NCQG, which is looking at different climate finance. And I think that's something which is really important that Australians are able to educate themselves on, looking at how can we as Australia help finance the losses of developing countries and of countries that are really suffering as a result of climate change. And I think, yeah, education on, adaptation, education on mitigation, making sure that we understand. Nobody will ever understand the COP process, but we can try and understand the theory behind the different things which are being decided there. I think the main thing to prepare for Azerbaijan is that it will be a significantly smaller conference in terms of the number of observers who are able to be there, and also obviously overflow badges. So it's really important to consider how can we try and make influence prior to the COP itself rather than coming to Baku, because it's very unlikely that a third of Australians who were there this year will be able to, or last year would be able to come this year.
Does that mean that a civil society group like youth need to be perhaps more organised in advance of COP?
Yeah, 100%. And that's something which we really have been working on, is seeing how can we actually try and influence, or also understand the government's position prior to the COP, because once you're at the COP, you can just go up to the negotiator and say, "What's Australia doing on this?" But that's a lot harder if it's over email, or if it's, if you're in Canberra, it might be a bit easier. But being in Fremantle, there are only so many politicians who have the knowledge, or the expertise in that field to be able to ask. We, as the youth constituency, worked really hard it last year in 2023 to make sure that our global youth statement was completed for pre-COP, which was a month before the actual COP, to try and allow for parties to, include those youth views. But yes, it certainly is a matter of working earlier in the year, making sure that, I mean, we are working very like all year. It's not a fact of, just starting a few weeks before COP, but it is about looking at how can we, within Australia, organise our local conferences of youth earlier. How can we make sure that our national youth statement is distributed to the politicians and to the delegation 2 or 3 months in advance rather than 4 weeks in advance, So there's always going to be improvements, but we do all work on a volunteer basis, and that, on top of school, on top of university, on top of work. It's not as easy as it is for, government delegation to spend 40 hours a week on a position paper or something in the lead up to COP.
Well, congratulations to you and all of your youth colleagues for what you are able to do. I admire what you've done immensely. You've been going through year 12, you've had exams, you've been preparing for this. It's really phenomenal. And I gather from everything you've said and talking as we have been over Zoom that you had, using the Australian vernacular, a bloody good time, despite all of the pressures and watching the text go this way and that, and the final watered down conclusions being reached. Am I right?
It's a good question. I think there were very, very, very many positive aspects of it. There were also, a lot of things which disappointed. But I think overall, it's such a privilege to be able to attend an event like that and to be able to, informally represent Australian youth. That's something which is such a privilege to be able to do, and for me to be able to be on ground to not only work with just Australians, but for me to be able to help lead some of the international youth space. I think that's something which will hopefully benefit in the future when we can see the change happening. And yeah, I think being able to go to a COP like that and to experience the whole process, it really just increases your capacity and your knowledge about how it works, which is, something we all so desperately need to know more of. So yes, I'm very thankful for the opportunity to have been able to go and to be a part of, such a large conference.
We're about to sign off, Amelia, but let me ask at a more personal level, what comes next for you?
Yeah, so I will be in Europe for the next few months, working very strongly in the younger the youth constituency. We're already, planning what will happen for Baku and all of that. But yes, I will on a personal level, I will be over in Europe for a few months visiting family. Obviously, after finishing Year 12, half my family's over in Europe, so really excited to spend a bit more time with them. As well as obviously, while you're over here, it's a lot easier to do a lot of work because you're not up at 1 a.m. meetings every single night for 5 hours. So yeah, really gonna, use this opportunity to be able to learn so much more without it really impacting, my schooling, or my mental health as well.
And once you get back here, what does next year hold for you?
Yes, I'm actually going to be starting university in probably in October in Germany as well. So I have German citizenship, and I think for me, I want to study international relations, and so it kind of makes more sense for me to be in the European space, where everything is a bit closer and it's a bit easier to be involved. But I do hope to, be able to come back to Australia and to, engage with the Australian youth again, and keep up to date with everything. We'll be coming back to visit, and of course, Freo is the first stop on the list. But yeah, I'll be, trying to see, whether Europe kind of makes more sense from my point of view in terms of being able to be engaged.
Amelia, I'm really pleased we were able to meet today to talk about your COP28 experience in Dubai. It's been fascinating talking to you. Our listeners will know just from listening to you speak how engaged, how informed you have been. Thank you on behalf of all of us who really care about the transition to net zero in the whole climate change debate for being there and representing the Australian youth voice. Thanks a lot, and we look forward to talking with you down the track to see what happens leading up to the next COP. Thanks for joining me
Yeah,
today.
thanks for having me, and thank you to everyone else who's doing all the amazing work. It is really a mixed effort.